Welcome to the Food Founders interview from ProCop. Today's guest is Ross Heathcote, founder of Burra Broth. And if you don't know, Burra Broth have built a range of tasty products that deliver protein and natural collagen for great gut health and general well-being. I'm very excited to find out how she established a business, has maintained their award-winning taste and quality, and kept sustainability at the heart of the business, all while scaling up to satisfy listings with the likes of Waitrose, Ocado, Whole Foods, Planet Organic, Holland & Barrett, and more. Welcome, Ros.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I guess the first question is, what drove you to start Burra Broth? And maybe tell us a bit about the benefits of the product as well.
Basically, it was back in 2015. I was working at Coca-Cola. I was a data analyst and software developer. So I worked for the European team at Coke and would travel all over developing software. And it was quite stressful. And I found that my health was just not optimum. I was suddenly getting weird symptoms and allergies. I suddenly started to develop, I was getting quite rashy. I was getting rosacea and I seemed to react to everything. My digestion wasn't good. And I just felt quite inflamed and couldn't really figure out what was going on. So I decided to spend 200 quid and get an allergy test and discovered I was allergic to perfume all of a sudden, anything with scent, which meant that I had to remove all these things from my life, which was actually quite a lot. When you get into the detail, it's a huge amount of products in your life that you buy from the supermarket. So suddenly I couldn't use fabric softener. I couldn't like anything. It was like back to basics. Then I did the same with my diet. I went to a nutritionist who said, it's because your body's so inflamed, you're reacting to everything. So you need to build up your gut health. And I was like, well, how do I do that? And one of the suggestions was bone broth, as well as sort of stripping out lots of refined foods and gluten for a bit and just seeing what works and what doesn't. So I kind of went really basic with my diet and meat, fish, green vegetables. That was kind of it for a little while. And bone broth really helped. And obviously there was nowhere to buy it. And I knew about bone broth because, you know, it's basically chicken soup was kind of how I saw it. And my mum used to make that when I was growing up. And I noticed my siblings all live in California and I'd seen it was a product that you could buy off the shelf, but it didn't seem to exist here. So I had to make it myself, which was actually a real pain. So I started going to the butchers and asking for their bones, which was often like, how many dogs do you have? Because I would take so many bones from the butcher from my local market. And that's how I kind of got really into it. And I found that I was making it every day and I had this slow cooker constantly on the go. And by the end of a batch, you end up with sort of a cup's worth of bone broth.
Oh, right.
And that would last me like half a day. So I realized that I need a lot of this stuff and it's actually quite like energy and labor intensive. So that was kind of how I got into it. And then through that, the butcher that I was going to, I got so obsessed with trying to find good bones that I took a photo of the butcher and put it on Twitter and said, anyone who needs good, like grass-fed British bones, go here because they're really hard to find in London. And the butcher got in touch and was like, could you help me, that picture, I want to put it on the website. And I was like, oh yeah, by the way, your website link doesn't work properly because I worked in IT. So he was like, well, why don't you come and help me with my digital marketing and I'll give you as many bones as you like.
Pay you in bones.
Yeah. And I was like, that's a pretty good deal. How many do you have? And he was like, oh, abattoir in Cumbria, we have to incinerate them because nobody wants them. They're too heavy to transport anywhere. And yeah, they're a waste product and really expensive to throw away. In an instant, I sort of had a moment where I thought, okay, I need to do something about this. So sort of rang my mum and said, I've just met someone who's going to change the rest of my life. And she said, wonderful, darling, you know, like very supportive of my sort of whimsical ideas. And I immediately set up a company, and within 2 weeks had found a kitchen in East London and decided to sort of give it a go, basically.
Did you quit your job at that point, or did you do it alongside for a while?
No, certainly not. No, I actually, and that, like, I just got to the point in my life where I was debt free. But you know, always typical, isn't it? And I didn't have any, like, despite a lot of people's preconceptions, we didn't have any family money or anything. So I was supporting myself, but I was sort of single, had a decent income. So basically I borrowed £6,000 off a mate and put the deposit down on the kitchen for 3 months' rent. And then every month just put basically most of my salary into the business over the course of 2 years. Wow. And didn't have a life really for a couple of years, which actually sort of suited me because I think I was 31 and I was just like, do you know what, I'm a bit done with going out all the time, and you know, I thought I need something else to go on in my life. So yeah, decided to do that and worked full-time whilst getting the business. I launched it online initially, just on Instagram and a little website. And in the first week, we got like 30 orders. And I remember just being like so overwhelmed. Like, it's quite a tearful moment. Like, oh my God, like other people want this. Clearly there's, you know, there's an appetite for it because it's not available.
And this is seven or 8 years ago sort of thing.
9 years ago now. Yeah, 2015. Yeah.
So you're tapping into the kind of gut health community, if that's the right word.
I think so, yeah. I mean, yeah, for me, it was about gut health. And actually, my sister has ulcerative colitis, which is similar to Crohn's, and it's sort of quite aggressive autoimmune disease. And a lot of people with her, you know, her disease rely on bone broth quite a lot. And we've discovered this now since running the business, that anybody with inflammatory diseases is after bone broth, basically. So there's that, as well as people with MS, or and a lot of people that are on you know, going through chemotherapy, who don't have much of an appetite. So it's sort of quite a broad sort of recovery product.
And you say you worked at Coca-Cola, but you weren't really in the food industry, I think.
No, I was. I mean, my career was, I used to fix computers when I came out. I did a music degree, believe it or not.
Okay.
But I wanted to be a sound engineer, so I was techie. And I knew how to fix computers, so it was easy to get a job doing that. And then got trained in this SAP software, which is like what all the big blue chip companies run. And sort of worked at Burberry, worked at Vodafone, and then I worked at Coca-Cola. So it was always sort of big blue chip firms. And I loved working at Coke, actually. It was great. But yeah, I just sort of managed to find any spare hour that I had left to do bone broth. So, yeah.
And how much trial and error was there in terms of creating the product? Did you have a recipe you were working from, or?
I mean, not really. I mean, there are a few recipes online, but ultimately it was a lot. It was, I mean, and it's long because you have to cook for like 24 hours, basically. You have to cook this stuff. So you don't know how it's going to turn out until the end. So there were quite a lot that were gross, actually. And when I meet people who buy our product, they're like, God, I've tried making it myself and it was disgusting. How do you make it taste so good?
Actually, a good barrier to entry is always useful, though, isn't it?
Well, and for such a simple product, you know, because it is, I mean, it's not anything particularly complex. It is bones, vegetables, water, and seasoning. But I guess getting the way you produce it right and the ratios right. And I've always been an absolute nerd about the ingredients we use. So I wouldn't use tap water. I was using spring water, and still to this day we use spring water in all of our broths. So we don't filter tap water. We actually have it brought over in tankers and twice a week. And yeah, so, and pink Himalayan salt, and everything's organic, and we're really, really strict on our provenance. And I think that it does show, it shines through in the products. And I do think a big part of it is the water. But I've got a I've got a sort of extreme sense of taste and smell. Some might call it like hypersensitive, so which can be an affliction because I can smell a cigarette a mile away, even though I used to smoke. But yeah, so like anything, it's just it's very pronounced. So yeah, I'm quite particular with the broth.
So what? Which? I mean, there's a good dozen, 15 products in the range now.
Yeah, I think about we've actually refined it a little bit, but yeah, it's between 12 and 15.
Which one came first, or which ones came first, and how have you kind of then expanded the range, and what's gone into making those decisions and picking the flavors and all that kind of stuff?
Well, it's an interesting one because we still manufacture all our own products. So we have a big kitchen in West London, and we've never really outsourced. And I think that's actually led our MPD quite strongly. You know, I meet other brands who outsource and I do think, oh, that sounds lovely. Because you can just come up with something and think, oh, now where could we get that made? Whereas we've sort of been limited by what we have. And I think often limitations drive more innovation in a strange sort of way. So we kind of joke that we make hot, wet stuff. So that's kind of what our business is. So ultimately, you know, and we are a broth company, that's in our name. So for me, it was quite obvious that we were just going to expand the range, which has actually been great because so many people are quite particular about what meat they eat. And so, you know, we've had people like, oh, I'm allergic to chicken, which blows my mind. I didn't know you could be allergic to chicken. But we have certain customers who are, and for religious reasons, some people will only have lamb and chicken or, you know, whatever it is. So we basically just expanded to any species that I'm confident on the provenance of. So we started with chicken and beef, organic chicken, organic beef, all British. And we launched into Selfridges within about 4 months of since starting the business.
Oh, excellent.
Because they found us on Instagram, which was kind of amazing. So we launched with those two. And I always got advised, launch with three products. You want an odd number. But we didn't. And it hasn't seemed to have done any, you know, done us any harm. But yeah, so for a long time, it was just chicken and beef. Which again, I used to feel like I worked on the airlines because chicken or beef. You know, like two options. But yeah, so that was for a long time. And then eventually I found a good fish supplier. So we did fish and we're actually just about to relaunch our fish because I struggled to find a sustainable supplier that I really trusted who could also meet our scale. So it's taken me a long time, but I finally found one.
Excellent.
So yeah, and then obviously lamb, and you know, we've gone that way, and then we did start to do meals. So we do a product with Planet Organic co-branded, which is quinoa and chicken and vegetables in a broth.
And how did that come about? Did they kind of approach you, or did you take it to them? Or
yeah, it's funny, you know, we worked with Planet Organic for a long time. They're one of our earlier customers, and in all honesty, the buyer and I just got on so well, and the broth just sold so well, and we just decided, why don't we try and do something together? We're both big fans of seeing lots of collaborations, and it's like you see it quite often now that brands are collaborating.
Yeah.
And so we thought, why not? You know, it'd be mutually beneficial. They're a big loyal customer of ours, and I mean, it's proven quite well because in the chiller with the soups and the broths, out of five shelves, we're in three, you know, we're across three of them. So we're quite dominant in that space now. And customers love the products. So it's going well.
Excellent. And as you've grown, I mean, you talked about tapping into the sort of gut health and things like that. Who are you making products for? Do you have have you done loads of research? Have you done lots of testing? Do you have a sense of who you're making for? Or is it more... no pun intended, is it more about gut feel about who you're making it for?
Honestly, yeah. I mean, gut feel has basically been how I've led this business to date. And when we've done things that haven't quite felt right, they've not worked out. So, you know, I do really trust it. You know, I've always said that this business was for me. It was products that I wanted to buy that I couldn't buy. And I've always been one of those people that looks at back of pack. And I think there's been an assumption that consumers are less savvy than they are. And I think we've sort of tapped into, and there's lots of brands like us now who have, you know, basically elevated those customers and highlighted the fact that there are plenty of people looking at back of pack, and you can't pull the wool over their eyes, and that they do know that what happens in factories, and that there are processing aids that aren't declared, and there are things that go on. So I think we've tried to be really transparent, because when you're worried about your health, you do want to know exactly what's going on with your food. And what we found, especially with our product, I mean, we do a lot of D2C. And if a delivery is missed, we realize that a lot of our customers are people that can't get out of bed. You know, there's a lot of people with really bad health issues who this is giving them strength. So we've sort of had to take it super seriously what our customers want. And if a delivery is missed, it can be disastrous for certain people. So so we do listen to them. And we sort of found that there was quite a lot of people that couldn't digest onion. So we did this low FODMAP range, and that's gone incredibly well as well, which was surprising to me that we had so much demand for it. And now we're being asked to do one, which is literally just bones and water. Which I sort of said, God, that's going to taste awful, but that's what people want. So, you know, we will do that.
And what forum did that come up?
I mean, we get it through Instagram. A lot of people will, you know, direct message us and ask for certain products. Again, we have a lot of people that will organically post about us, generally nutritionists and naturopaths, which seems to be quite booming. I think a lot of people are training in that area now, and a lot of people are blogging about it. So, yeah, you know, I was messaging someone yesterday, and she's doing the AIP diet, which I can't remember what it stands for now, but autoimmune something. But she's trying to figure out, she's doing elimination. And I said, oh, do you want some broth? And she said, can you do one without pepper in it? And I was like, oh, okay. So, that's quite common. And then we do a yearly survey with our D2C customers, and it's really detailed, and they give us so much information. Got such a loyal following that they're really happy to share their personal stories, and it really helps us.
Where are you currently selling? And did you start D2C and then expand out? Or actually, you know, Selfridges was 4 months in. So how did that all work?
Well, Selfridges was a funny one. I totally freaked out because I was like, oh, my God, we've got this tiny kitchen. We've got one 72 litre pan that we run once a week, you know, to make these products. And yeah, I mean, Selfridges is actually, it doesn't sell that much volume, actually. But at the time I was quite naive, so I was sort of starry eyed about it. And they did their first order, and the Coca-Cola office is the street behind Selfridges. So I got an Uber and hand delivered our first delivery, and then walked to the office and worked that day, and was like sat there thinking, oh, my God. So I used to go and do sampling after work. So I just bring my kit and like walk down. But yeah, we were in Selfridges for a bit, and we carried on D2C. And basically the kitchen that I was hiring at the weekends was a catering company, and I paid their staff to make the broth. I sort of created the processes. I think because I had an IT background, I'm sort of process obsessed, which has actually worked out quite well, quite good at spreadsheets and processes. So managed to, I did all the ordering and processed sales orders and stuff remotely. And then the team, I would send them a mandate, and they would just follow the mandate basically each week. And then we got listed with a company called Coombe Farm Organic, who no longer exists. They've now been bought and changed their name. But they put a lot of money behind Google Ads for bone broth, because they said, oh, we noticed people are buying lots of bones off us. And so they would send me their bones, and I would make the broth, send them the broth, and they would sell it on their website. And it just went mad. I mean, it went mad. We just had to keep expanding the kitchen. I had to upgrade the electrics in this tiny kitchen twice. And in the end, it was just like we'd outgrown it after 2 years. So then I had to take investment from friends and family. I raised 125 grand. So it's sort of like 15 grand here, 20 grand here, just from mates who were like, oh, I can't afford a flat, but I've got a lump of money, who sort of believed in what we were doing. And I'm pleased to say now that that is worth quite a lot more now.
Yeah.
And which is really joyous. Like one of my friends who's a social worker has sort of, you know, currently sat on enough to buy himself a home and things like that, which is really like wonderful. So yeah, so that's kind of how I did the first raise. Then I quit my job and we moved into a facility, which we've since moved out of. We're now in another facility. So yeah, it's been quite a lot of moving, and we'll probably have to move again in about a year.
Brilliant. And in terms of marketing as well, have you tried lots of different ways of doing it? Have you found some things that work for you? Or any lessons for people listening?
Do you know, it's funny because I was saying I was listening to Amy Mooring do this podcast from Hunter and Gather, who is a friend of mine, and I'm such a big fan of theirs, and we kind of share a similar community of customers. And they are just such masters at marketing. I was like, God, like, and I always watch them in awe, because we actually, we do market, you know, we do things. But as far as educating the customer about the health benefits of broth, I've been quite reticent. It's a mixture of not wanting this to be a fad product, or for people to think that this is some kind of elixir that's going to cure all. It worked for me, and it's worked for a lot of people. We have a lot of anecdotal evidence to say that it's really improved people's health. However, we don't have the funds to do a big, you know, actual certified study on the benefits yet. And it's sort of emerging. There's more evidence about collagen and how it's benefiting you. But so for me, it was always about, well, it has to be delicious, and it just happens to be good for you. I think that's the way we need to market this. And that's kind of always been our angle. So for me, it's like, why are you using a stock cube? It's basically war food. It's like a crumbly lump of sugar, salt, and yeast extract. You know, you want all your ingredients to be something you recognize that you could make from scratch. And I think that's the best way to try and fix your health, is to just know that everything you have that you make your dinner with is something you could buy raw and you could make it from scratch. And so yeah, for me, I'm like, everyone should just be replacing their stock with a really good broth or stock that's made with clean ingredients. So that's always kind of been our marketing, is that it's also just, you can cook all your food with this. But we've noticed, well, every year we do a survey with our customer, and 50% of them do drink it every day in a mug, because it's seasoned to sip. And for people with health issues, it's kind of, instead of a coffee or a tea, this is like a much better option. So yeah, it's interesting. It's quite a versatile product, but as far as marketing goes, I always try and show people how versatile it is as a product as well. That it's not just to have in a mug. It is also instead of using a stock cube.
Yeah, and then that focus on taste. I mean, I struggled. I Googled and tried to find out if there's anyone else who had 12 Great Taste Awards. I failed to find out or not. But
we have 14 now.
Oh, hold the press. 14. I mean, that's pretty staggering. And pretty much every product's got a Great Taste Award.
Yeah.
Was that a deliberate strategy, or is that, and how much impact do you think has that had on the business and sales and building your customer base?
It's funny, you know, again, it's just, as a consumer, I always kind of believed in the Soil Association stamp on the front of pack, believed like, oh, organic, I bet a lot goes into that. And I've since learned a lot goes into that. And the same with Great Taste. It was kind of wonderful to discover the process, and it's, you know, there is a lot that goes into it and a lot of people that will mark and score your product. And whilst taste is subjective, it's sort of done with enough experts that you can really trust what they're saying. And I always trusted it. I would always, if I had two options, if the one option had the great taste, I'd always pick the great taste. So for me, it meant a lot. So yeah, from the very beginning, I was like, let's try and ensure that we submit it. And it's only once a year. So if you miss the window, you've got to wait a whole year again. And you've got to wait months for your results. So we're always like, oh, on the day that we get our results. But yeah, I feel like it has made a difference. It's hard to get the data on that. Mm. But for me, you know, I think it shows that we really care about our products and how they taste. So yeah.
How big's the team?
Well, we're at payroll this month, I think is 35 people. Yeah, I mean, again, because we have our own production facility, we also have our own warehouse. So I have a whole team picking and packing that do our D2C. And then we have a production team in the kitchen as well. So a lot of that, probably about 20 of those 35 are, you know, operationally on the ground. And then the rest is, yeah, back office.
Is there much that you kind of, I mean, presumably some of the things you used to outsource and then you brought in-house, or did you always have your own kind of warehousing and logistics?
No, I mean, we've always done our own D2C, which has been a struggle, actually. And now we've had to take on a whole extra warehouse to do that, so which they're very happy about because we were really struggling for space. It was sort of front of our warehouse that was mainly kitchen. And we've always made our own products. So yeah, we've kind of held on to a lot, which, you know, I was at an event last night and I realized how rare that is amongst food brands, is to A, make your own products and B, do your own warehousing. So I kind of love it though. And I like, maybe it's because I'm a control freak, but I kind of like, I like, and it's, and everybody communicates with each other and have lunch together. And it's nice, you know, our office is part of that too. So it's we're not sort of separated out in a separate office in central London. We're all at the facility, the marketing team, as well as the operations and production team.
Are people ordering on subscription kind of thing? Is that a, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And we're just redoing our website now to offer more versatility when it comes to subscriptions. But yeah. There's a lot of people that will have weekly deliveries of broth. I think that's what really blew Ocado's mind when we launched with them, which was about 7 years ago now. And they were a bit like, we don't really know who's going to buy this. And then after a few months, they were like, people are buying like 10 packs a week.
What is this stuff?
Yeah, they were like, what are they doing with it? And we were like, they're having it every day. Like they're having it instead of tea or coffee. So, so yeah, people who are on subscription, we've now got big 1 kilo packs that are sort of better value for those people that are having it constantly. So, yeah.
Excellent. And I noticed you're a B Corp. What's the story of that? Why did you go for that? And what does it do for the business?
I mean, B Corp's a big sort of beast. It's for those who don't know what B Corp is, which sadly a lot of people still don't know what B Corp is, and we're working hard to change that. It's to promote people and planet as well as profit from a sort of capitalist perspective. So if you have a business, it's not just about the bottom line. It's also about ensuring that you have measures, metrics, scores against what you're doing for the people that work for you, for your suppliers, for your customers, as well as just the biodiversity of where you're sourcing your products and where you're making them and how you're transporting them. It really covers so much. It's quite an extensive questionnaire you have to do. It took us a year to complete. And it goes into real detail, and it impacts everything with regards to your HR policies to make sure that you're looking after your staff, as well as how you work with your suppliers and customers. And because our business is quite operationally led, I think it's really quite tough to fit into B Corp and to score well. But we have, and we've just recertified. And yeah, basically you get scored each year on all of those things across governance, people, environmental impact. And so that's what B Corp is. And there's, yeah. I think in the UK we have the highest per capita. I think in London there's more than 10,000 B Corps, which is sort of the biggest booming city in the world for B Corps. And the community is great. But there's still a lot of work to do. I think it's a system that a lot of people can sort of abuse. And I think a lot of people assume it's greenwashing. But it's meant that I am always, it's challenging me on how we grow the business now and ensuring that I'm putting policies in place that protect everybody, and that profit and greed is not the driver of what we're doing. And it's not really, I mean, I always joke with people, if I wanted to make money, I would have stayed in tech. So, you know, I've realised that food is, it's not all about the money. There's a lot of heart in food. So, yeah, the B Corp community with food and drink brands is pretty immense.
Oh, yeah, I'd not really thought about that. That must be, yeah, must be a good resource to tap into. And how has the brand journey been? Because I think they really stand out. It's obviously a lot about pouches, isn't it?
Yes.
It worked. How has the brand developed? I mean, did you do loads of work on it early on? Is it something you've left to later? How has it evolved?
No, not much work on it early on. It was really one of those things of when I decided to start the business, I did a bit of research and realized that pouches was the way to go for us. Just from at the time, we were limited on storage space. And it just made sense to me logically that they take up very little room when they're empty and very little room, like from beginning to end, to dispose of them, throw them away. Light flexible plastic is actually a really useful material. So it was always pouches. I was like, right, I need to just design some stickers. And I had a mate who worked in advertising who helped me get a logo designed for like 200 quid. And then I had another friend who is an artist. He's an excellent artist. And he was sort of between studios, homes that were often sort of squats, shall we say. Right. So he lived on my sofa for a few weeks. And so as payment, he did me some illustrations. And then I could do stuff on sort of, you know, on the computer. So I sort of put it together as far as I somewhat pulled together the design. And we had that for a long time, probably longer than we should have done. But it kind of got us over the line. And I won't lie, I think a lot of brand owners would say the same, but you start to get really sick of your branding after a while. For a long time, I wanted to rebrand, but just couldn't afford it. And eventually sort of put aside a chunk of money, found a branding agency that I love and get on with so well. And they just got it. They just absolutely got what we were trying to do. And that was about a year and a half, 2 years ago that we rebranded. And I think it's really now made the business a lot more grown up. And we have full brand guidelines and a color palette and all those things that when I worked, you know, I worked for Burberry and I used to have to design lots of things. I always remember being inspired by that, like that they had this full palette.
Yeah, proper brand. Sort of
proper thing. Branding, yeah. So I was like, oh my God, we're grown-ups now. We're a legitimate brand.
Did you notice the team kind of felt that when that was applied, everyone sort of felt uplifted by it?
100%. And also we kind of, with the rebrand, everybody in operations, we got them a branded fleece and they had the logo on it. And we just got them it for a photo shoot that we had on site. And that was a year and a half ago. And every day I come in, everyone's wearing their fleece. They're so proud of that. And I love it. So, yeah, it feels like everybody's really like owning the brand now.
Can we talk about funding? I mean, you mentioned the sort of friends and family kind of fundraise. Have we done any others? Are you planning to kind of go forward with funding? Or
friends and family. There's one friend who's a sort of angel investor, really. And they have helped me. I wanted to do a big raise again recently, and I sort of sent my deck out to a few people, just a field. So up until last year, we'd raised in total around, think it was around 180,000. And that was to get us to about just under 2 million turnover. And then this year, we grew a lot this year. We've grown over 125% over the last 12 months. So we should be just hitting 4 million and we're at a run rate of 5. And I suddenly needed a lot more cash.
Yes.
So I did a little raise. And in the end, one of my angel investors, just as I was about to start looking at VCs, said that they would be good for it. And gave us, which is great because I've been left to my own devices. Nobody really bothers me. And I'm kind of like it that way. I have a nice non-exec board now that advise me. But I've sort of been quite wary and heard a lot of horror stories about working with VCs and giving people seats that you don't necessarily want to give seats. And so I've tried to avoid that as much as possible, which is why our growth has not been too aggressive. It's been relatively organic because, I had no massive ambitions for this brand. I just wanted it to become what it needs to become in a kind of hippy dippy way. And now I am ambitious for it. I want it to be in more supermarkets, but I'm not willing to sell my soul to do that at the same time.
Yeah. What are the sort of big scary goals for the next, you know, couple of years? What do you want to be doing?
Well, we have a facility in West London, and our lease, it sounds like they're probably going to knock down the buildings we're in in 2026. So my next big challenge, I've just hired an operations director who starts in July, and her and I are going to just work for the next year on finding a new site.
Forever home kind of thing.
Yeah. And something, I met someone yesterday who's run a company who's expanded 4 times now and has gone from nothing to 47 million in the last 10 years. And he was like, always get a bigger site than you need. And you always think you're never going to fill it, and you will fill it. So, we've got to find a big site now. So that's a big project, and that's going to be, we'll probably have to do another fundraise for that. And so, yeah, that'll be a big challenge. Yeah.
Is there something you wish you could go back in time and tell yourself at the start? What are the things that would have saved you grief?
Oh, well, firstly, get a trademark early on. So that's a big one. Do that first before you do anything. The second thing, don't let anybody throw you off your game. I think I even now I get people who worry for me about competition, or, you know, oh, have you seen what they're doing? And I sometimes would let it get through and I would let it bother me. And I just stay in your lane. Just focus on what you want to do. It doesn't matter. And if people are on the journey with you, they'll stick with you. And so I think sometimes you can get bogged down with what everyone else is doing, and social media and LinkedIn and all these things can sometimes like really bum you out when you're having a bad day. So it's just not to take any of that too seriously.
Thanks, Ross, for joining us.
Pleasure.
If you want to find out more about Burra Broth, find stockists and buy online, you can go to www.burrabroth.co.uk. You can listen to previous Food Founders interviews, including the one with Amy Mooring of Hunter and Gather, at frogop.co.uk/podcasts, or search for Food Founders interviews wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're using Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Google Podcasts, reviews would be greatly received on there for us. Thanks again, Roz. I look forward to 5 million, 10 million, 20 million, 50 million over the next few years.
Thank you. Me too.
Thanks, everyone. Take care.